Hey, welcome back, everybody. It's time for another episode of OC Spotlight. The one show, maybe the only show, that shows you the most interesting people doing the most amazing things right here in our own backyard. And today, well, we've got somebody special. He's going to be giving a talk tomorrow. We want to highlight what he's doing because it isn't just about our backyard. It's about that big backyard we call the world. And we're privileged to have with us today Dr. Kyle Longley, Director of the War, Diplomacy, and Society Program and Professor of History right here at Chapman University. Welcome, sir.
I appreciate your the opportunity to talk with you.
Wow, that's a mouthful. What is the War, Diplomacy, and Society Program? That's a lot to pack in. What is the program over at Chapman?
Yes, it's a master's level program where we're trying to prepare students at the graduate level to go back out into the world and with a better understanding of the interaction of war and diplomacy and then how it has affected society and how societies affect our abilities to wage war on to, conduct diplomacy. So what we're hoping to do, we have each year two State Department mid-level or mid-career FSOs come in. We have people from the military who have retired.
FSO meaning Foreign Service Officer. Okay, we got to always spell out the acronyms there, right?
Yes, I worked in the federal government for a little while, and I should know better than just throw out those acronyms.
Right.
But we try to bring in, and then we have a lot of our students doing 4+1s, where they get a undergraduate degree in 4 years, but also get the graduate degree in one.
Oh, wow.
So they're going out and doing different things, like working for the State Department, working for the FBI, working in museums. They're doing all kinds of very interesting things, but we believe, and the higher administration, I just had a wonderful meeting with Dr. Strupa, believe that we're making a difference by educating the future leaders of America.
Well, I certainly think so. For anybody who's listened to the show, they know my background. 100 million years ago, I went to the University of Michigan. I was an honors grad in the political science and history department, wrote my senior honors thesis on the Nixon-Kissinger foreign policy and its impact on the Cold War, and then quickly put all this aside, and my dad said, now you got to get a job. And so I came out and didn't know what to do, and I thought about the Foreign Service for a while, but drifted to California to be a radio star or whatever, and came out and ended up here in Orange County and started this whole thing 12 years ago as a community radio station, community conversation. So I said it's like a bug that bit me early, and I never quite recovered from it. Is that the way foreign affairs is? And for you either look at the world locally or you look at the world internationally.
Well, ironically, one of the reasons I look at Latin America so closely is being raised in West Texas. That was always a fundamental relationship, especially that with U.S. and Mexico. So My orientation was always looking south, not really to the north or to the east or Europe, just because I lived in a predominantly Latino community.
Right.
And I just thought that was the norm. And here in Southern California, if anything, that's reinforced, but also with the Asian American community and others that have settled here. It's such a diverse community, and it's such an important part of the world. The Pacific Rim is the future, and Southern California is right in the perfect place to be able to take advantage of that.
Exactly. And what happens in the world affects all of us. Look at what happened in China when COVID started to spread. Suddenly it's affected all of us. This notion that America goes through, and it's not a new notion. We went through it, you know, 100 times in our history, maybe, this isolationism. We're protected by our two shores. What happens beyond those shores, we don't care about. It doesn't impact us. But it does, really, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Just ask my wife who went to fill up the car. Remember when gas prices before February, where they were versus where they are now as a result of war? We did a bunch of presentations in the spring semester for our students at Chapman with the community and making the point how this war is directly affecting all of us.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's at the forefront of this battle between authoritarianism and democracy.
Absolutely.
And all the way across the world, but it's still having its shape. It affects us on a daily basis, and it's going to affect us in a long-term basis.
Well, let's talk about this, because the world goes through waves and tides here where America, not just where America is interested in the world and then America pulls back. We're in one of those pullback phases here after we're exhausted, after Iraq, and we were exhausted after Vietnam. That was what my thesis was about. You know, are we just going to pull back in? Or are we going to continue fighting the Cold War? Are we just going to retreat into some isolationism? And of course, there was an impulse to do that, but we didn't. We stayed engaged in the world. And after the endless war in Iraq, and both sides, left, right, and center, said, we're exhausted enough, let's pull out. And we did. Afghanistan, Iraq, all this stuff, we finally pulled out of it. There's a certain impulse to say, the heck with what's happening in the rest of the world. But the world goes on without us. And Ukraine was a perfect example of that. It wasn't a fight we were even thinking about. And yet when it happened, look at the how we got drawn into it and how the implications have hit us hard. Wheat, oil, all these things that we rely on.
Yeah. Well, and that's what my talk tomorrow night is going to be about, the closest of our neighbors, and that's Latin America. And historically, the interaction and the integration between the two regions has fundamentally shaped our societies. I mean, look at one of our largest trading partners, of course, is Mexico. But then you look at immigration issues. Those are directly tied to what's going on in Central America. And then you look at the environment. That's Brazil, oil, Venezuela. You cannot dismiss the region. We've tried to over time, and we've done so at our own peril.
Well, and let's talk about that a little bit. My historical recollection, it's maybe a little rusty, maybe not as sharp as yours, is that, you know, once upon a time, one of our early founders, James Monroe, created this thing called the Monroe Doctrine that said, this is our sphere of influence. Stay out of it, Europe. You know, we're not going to let European powers or the rest of the world come in and run this region. And so we took that role upon us. But it seems like over the last, decade or two, we've been taken elsewhere, China, Russia, Europe. We don't seem to pay much attention. Is that a misconception on my part? I know we just had a recent summit of the Americas, and a whole bunch of them didn't even come this time.
No, I don't think that's a misperception. There was a wonderful, he was a scholar, a political scientist, and also worked in the federal government, in the State Department, named Robert Pastor. And he always talked about how Latin America was sort of like a whirlpool. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, we're always sort of on the edges of the whirlpool, and occasionally we get sucked down into it, and then ultimately released. During that time, when we're sucked down into it, we pay close attention.
Yeah,
Cuba
right.
in 1959, right. Central America in the 80s.
Right.
But historically, our attention gets pulled elsewhere, and justifiably, in the case of, you know, the rise of the Asian century that has been ongoing for the last 50 to 60 years.
Absolutely.
That our orientations are being much more focused on what's going on in China and what's Japan, Korea, Vietnam, all through that area. And I actually have fields in Latin America and in Asia. Hmm. So I see how they're completely interrelated.
So what's the current state of our relationship with South America? It seems to have been kind of at a low. Didn't we have the last couple of administrations have kind of ignored it, haven't really paid much attention. That's my perception. I hadn't made it a priority. And here we have, didn't we just have some sort of, whatever they call it, Summit of the Americas or something here in Los Angeles? And a whole bunch of people didn't even come.
Yeah, no, and we didn't, and the focus wasn't on it. And again, I think we're in that period where we're sort of just riding along sort of on the edges of the whirlpool. And Latin America, why we've been doing that, others have been actively involved there, including Russia and places like Venezuela.
China,
watch what
China
doing
certainly,
in terms
yeah.
of mineral extraction, building 4G networks and building infrastructure in places like El Salvador. And, you know, I will say maybe that's not the worst of things. Yeah, China's one thing, but the rest of the world sort of taking an active role where the United States is not seen as sort of the preponderant power, overpowering power, and others are.
Or even an interested power. I think too often when you read about the Latin America and Central America and South America in general, and they say, you just only come down when you want something. The rest of the time, you don't pay a whole lot of attention to it. So I don't know if that's a true statement or not, but one of the other trends, and I'm sure you're going to talk about this, it's certainly been something I've read a lot about. I don't know that most Americans have paid much attention to it, is the continuing shift from left to right. I don't know a whole lot about Latin American politics, except my general perception that they swing wildly from the left to the right. And that means you've got dictatorships in the 80s and under anti-communism. We supported all these dictatorial powers, these generals in Chile and all these type of places, who came to power after throwing out the extreme opposite, the Allende socialists and the left-wingers that take over, and then there's a right-wing revolt, and then there's a left-wing comeback. Where are we at in that left-right swing these days here?
Well, I think we have to be careful in terms of the left-right, because then we start using Cold War analogies that really are not as applicable.
Okay.
You know, you look at the whole concept of trying to create a more equitable society in Latin America, which has been a struggle from the beginning of independence. Simón Bolívar, his ideas have been infinitely more important than Lenin or Marx or others, but we sort of sometimes, unfortunately, when we use our terminology, we graft our preconceived notions onto that.
Okay,
and
fair enough.
And look at what's going on in the regions today. A lot of it is just authoritarianism versus democracy.
Right.
And it doesn't matter whether it's from the right or the left. It's a justification through ideology to justify authoritarian rule. And it doesn't matter whether you're Maduro or you're moving like what Bolsonaro would like to do, Ortega versus what you see in El Salvador. You know, it's more about that concept. And I think sometimes when we use left-right, and I will be using that tomorrow night to talk about the different, but what really is that unifying theme is authoritarianism.
So
we will rule. It's going to be through our lens, and it's going to be for our people.
Right.
Much like what we see in Russia, much like, you know.
Our way or the highway. We're going to dictatorially rule things. And that's, too often we think of authoritarianism as just a right-wing phenomenon, the generals that take over the thing. And yet, I remember studying World War II a million years ago, and somebody said, on some basic level, what's the difference between Hitler and Stalin? They both imprisoned and killed people, masses number of people.
Yeah.
One was on the left, one was on the right, one was a fascist, one was a communist. They supposedly are extreme opposites. And yet, in terms of the people, they both were ruled dictatorially under brutal regimes that started wars and killed their own people here.
Oh, no, there is no doubt. And the older I get, the more I study, I realize it has less to do with ideology and more to do with control.
Yeah.
And I think that is why I'm very hesitant. You know, I know I'll hear people say, well, socialists are taking over, or the right wingers are taking over. And I'm like, I think it's infinitely more complex than that. And they're
so
trying
too.
To address long existing conditions of lack of land reform, lack of job opportunities, lack of health opportunities. And what I will say is Latin America is so complex. It's more than 30 nations. And the Costa Ricans are not that similar to the Nicaraguans, even though they're neighbors.
Okay.
The Uruguayans and the Brazilians, very different. And so, you know, I could go and break this down, the Caribbean Basin and all these things. So that makes Latin America sometimes very frustrating for Americans because we want to group it into one.
So let's take a look. You threw out a couple names that I recognize, but I don't know. We just want to make sure the general public does. So some political hot points here, some people that are making noise, you know, not just the Cubans anymore and the continuing revolution there. But you mentioned people like, is it Bolsonaro, who's been more of a right-wing authoritarian figure in Brazil? You mentioned then Daniel Ortega, who was the Contras, and what was the other group they called? He was the left.
Sandinistas.
Yeah, and he was a Sandinista, wasn't he?
Yes, he was a leader of the Sandinistas.
So he's the extreme left wing, and he takes power and becomes just as dictatorial as anybody else that he opposed here. Is that true? Is that a fair definition?
Oh, very true. I mean, if you watch it and you look, it's all about control.
Yeah, I think so.
The ideology, it doesn't play nearly as much.
It's just an excuse.
It's
like two different teams, but they're still playing the same game here. Yeah.
Exactly. And that's the point I'm going to be making is, you know, we want to put it within our own lens that we can try to make some sense of it. But when it comes down to it, it's best control. That's like saying Putin, you know, Putin is no different from Ivan the Terrible, the person who established in some ways. I need to qualify that.
Sorry.
Yeah, he is different. But the same kind of control that Ivan the Terrible, who created the Romanov dynasty of the czars, is he really that much different?
Yeah.
The kleptocracy is now the royalty. You know, there's a lot of things there that I think many of my colleagues would argue this point and say ideology matters much more. I'm not,
I'm
as I
you.
Study it more, less inclined to think.
Dictators are dictators. Authoritarian figures are things. Whatever reason they're using to justify that, they empower one group of people and one people only, and they tend to breed corruption and cronyism and a certain class benefits. And like the Russian Revolution, one group throws the Romanovs out in the royalty and puts in a new kind of royalty, the Communist Party, and then they become the new royalty that have the special benefits and the special cars and the special DACAs and houses and all this
exactly.
stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well,
and that's what I think that's what I'm getting to the point of arguing, and that you will see that tomorrow night when I talk about that. That the, you know, I just had an interview with Will Hurd, the former congressman from Texas, CIA operative, and
fascinating.
We were
talking
about how even in our own American politics, we've become a horseshoe. The right and the left seem to bend toward each other more than the center. And it's all about who's going to be in control and able to dictate sort of their perception of what the world should be like rather than having compromise and things like that.
So let's hit a couple other hot points here. Clearly Maduro and Venezuela, that one gets thrown up usually by the right in this country here, that we don't want to end up like that. It's been a kind of a collapsed society, it seems like, here, that they've runaway inflation and people running over the borders. Is that still as chaotic as it once was here?
Well, I think you look at it that ebbs and flows also, depending upon what's going on. You know, we could look at the long history of immigration to the United States. And, you know, the most recent has been much more driven in Central America by the violence that has occurred in Central America.
Yeah,
as a result
gangs
of
and political violence and everything, yeah. Assassinations.
Yeah, and everything. Most of it is drug violence. And so, you know, that lack of opportunity. So, you know, that's why you see oftentimes they'll say, well, I've got Latino neighbors that don't want the immigration either. And I'm like, yeah, that's true. Many of them tend to be Mexican-American who look at these Central Americans as what the threat economically. And also they don't have the necessary things in common that, say, if it was fellow Mexicans and things like that. So the complexity is still there, and it will ebb and flow depending on what's going on the internal sources in Latin America. And that's one of the reasons I'll be talking about Bukele in El Salvador, you know, how he's tried to address the issue of the MS-13s, both through repression, but also negotiating with the MS-13s and the 18th Street Barrios. So all those issues are still, and they've been here for 100 years, and they'll probably be here for another 100.
So let me give you two more flashpoints that have flashed on the news here. One is certainly what's just the shocking result for many. This young kid becomes the head of Chile, and he was a left-wing, was he a revolutionary? Was he he certainly was part of the student movement down there, and nobody thought he had a prayer to unseat any of the business types or the right-wing types that have been ruling Chile for a long time here. But they're upset about a lot of the distribution you tell me, what's happening with this kid who suddenly was he like 30 or something like that? And
right, you know, I'm calling them millennial authoritarians.
Millennial authoritarians,
the best one is Bukele in El Salvador. But yeah, you're seeing this with Gustavo Petro. And
the other one I was going to mention, this guy who was literally a member of the the M19 guerrilla group that fought against the government for so long, and now he's in power?
Yeah. But, you know, much like Lula in Brazil, who had also been part of the anti-government movement and stuff, he becomes mainstream. Same with Gustavo Petro. If you look at his policies, they're basically social democratic policies that would bear a striking resemblance to that of Denmark or France or places like that. So, again, we have to watch how sort of these things sort of play out. But again, we try to reimpose some of our own Cold War mentality into the discussion. And it has such a limited, it dilutes the complexity of really what's going on. You look at Castillo recently in Peru. There you have a whole different set of issues because of the native peoples and which if he belongs. So again, the complexity of Latin America sometimes perplexes us to the point we throw up our hands and just say,
exactly.
That's just the way they are.
Exactly.
And when the reality is, you know, then again, comparing contrast of different evolutions, look at Costa Rica, may have the most vibrant democracy in the whole Western Hemisphere. But then you compare and contrast that to Haiti, which has its own set of issues.
Seems to be a failed nation state right now. There's nobody running the place.
Haiti has been one of the saddest situations to watch in probably the history of the region. And so I think, though, what I would make a point, and I keep going back to, is there's ebbs and flows, both in terms of this focus on authoritarianism, democracy, as people just sort of go back and forth and say, who's going to provide this for me? Who's going to address the land issues? Who's going to address my job? Who's going to address the education? And unlike some areas in the regions of the world, it just, again, has complexity.
Does it start with the land? Always Mexican politics has been filled with revolutions and counter-revolutions and then civil wars and everything. It always seems to come back to the land. Who owns the land? Who gets access to the land?
Yeah. Well, I think it was that for the longest period. Again, if you study the Mexican Revolution, for example, you look at most of the issues related to land reform and also who controlled the subsoil rights.
Right.
Same goes in a place like Guatemala in 54, leading to the counter-revolution. Same goes in Cuba. And, you know, noticeably, our conversation is not centered on Cuba, which 10 years ago would have been primarily the primary
front and center. Cuba, right.
Sort of, yeah, it disappeared. I've been watching the World Track and Field Championships, and there's a noticeable absence of Cuban athletes who historically have been very prominent in the track and field world, but they've sort of disappeared too, largely because the government can't subsidize them any longer and train them like they used to. And so, you know, again, there's just some long histories here.
I grew up in the day of watching, Cuba think they were going to export their revolution to the rest of the world, Africa in part, and certainly Central South America, when the famous poster of Che Guevara goes down to Bolivia to suddenly spark some movement there that was really not much going on, I don't think, there, and ends up getting killed, tracked down and killed there, trying to start a new revolution in Bolivia here. He wasn't from Bolivia. He's Argentinian on top of it, as I recall, right?
Well, yeah, and so you
go ahead.
You see all these things. But again, I think there's a repetitive nature. The thing I always tell people, I only get 30 minutes tomorrow night to address one of the most complex regions in the world. But I always say my ultimate goal is just to encourage people to learn more on their own and try to understand the difference between Mexico and El Salvador and Chile, and try to inform ourselves rather than relying too often on very simplistic definitions and descriptions to try to make sense of it. And it's so much more muddied and complex than that. But that's why we are talking like we are right now, to try to encourage people to understand this better.
Well, let's encourage them to understand the opportunity here to not just meet you, but to talk about something in an informed way that probably doesn't get much coverage in the media here. Because we don't pay much attention to it until it blows up, until it becomes an issue. And then, as you said, we get sucked into the vortex here. So tomorrow, this is Thursday, we're doing this on Wednesday, so this will be tomorrow, July 21st, at Antonello's Restaurant, right up by, what is that, South Coast Plaza area there? And the big fancy restaurant. You can go. It starts. The reception starts at 5:30. The main program begins at 6:30. There's a dinner. There's everything here. So they're going to feed you. No excuse not to come early and hang around late. And then there's a reception afterwards. What takes place in this? This is put on by the World Affairs Council, a wonderful group that, again, I don't think gets enough coverage for this. They put an extra effort into periodically holding these kinds of world affairs discussions for a world that's all too weary about the world right now here, and I don't encourage people to pull their heads back in the sand. Take an opportunity, go out and meet Dr. Kyle Longley, listen to his take on South America, and see if you don't learn something here. It's fascinating. Where can they get tickets? I think there's like $45 gets you the dinner if you're a member, or $50, something like that.
Right.
And again, I think I'll give a phone number here. They can go to theworldaffairscouncil.org. There's even a number here to call, 949-253-5751. 949-253-5751. They usually get pretty good attendance at these things. I've been to a couple of them.
Yes, we do.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And so we encourage people to join the organization because this is, we do at least one event a month, mm-hmm. oftentimes two, and we're bringing in people from all over the world. And we discuss all the regions. We try to do it in a bipartisan way to try to encourage interaction and discussion. And you get to meet a lot of very interesting people, many with global experience in business, politics. So it's an incredible organization. I'm very happy to be part of the executive board. And, you know, like I say, this is part of the mission of Chapman University, is to integrate with these types of organizations so we can help our students, help the community, and hopefully, in our own way, transform the world.
Last question. The title of your program that you, or you're the director of, is War, Diplomacy, and Society. Society, at least American society, can't decide. Should we lead with war first? You know, guns go in blazing and force people or take control or do things, or diplomacy. We seem to have soured on both of them as of late here. We don't seem to want to send troops anywhere, and we certainly don't seem to put much faith in talk anymore here. What's your take on it?
Well, I think that is, again, another ebb and flow. I think Iraq, Afghanistan did a number on us.
Right.
I think we're recovering, much like the Vietnam syndrome,
right.
shaped American foreign policy from 1975 for many, many years and still actually shapes it. And as someone that's written extensively on the experiences of combat soldiers in Vietnam and now writing a book on those who fought in Iraq, Afghanistan, you see remarkable continuity.
I think so. Yeah, it was all too eerie watching the helicopter take off from Afghanistan, just like those images of the helicopters leaving the embassy roof in Saigon in 75 or whatever it was.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And so, again, there's another, you know, history may not repeat itself, but it's oftentimes sure does rhyme.
It sure does. Well, let's make sure that we get an informed group of people out there for a lively, again, nonpartisan. This isn't what I appealed to me. It wasn't coming from a left perspective or a right perspective. It was just people who really want to try and understand the complexity of a region that we all too often overlook or don't understand. I think that's what I might take away from this.
I agree with that wholeheartedly, and the presentation will feature that also.
So the talk is specifically called, I'm looking at the pamphlet here, On the Brink, implying that something's going to change there. On the Brink, the current state of Latin American politics. Is that where it is? It's kind of on the edge? It could go one way or another? Or it could be.
That's the way I see it. And if you look at the economic indicators, you look at climate issues, you look at foreign policy, I'm a historian. I'm not a predictor of the future, but I can give you some good roadmaps.
Yeah, right. You can look backward and see where we've been, and that's often a predictor of where we're going here. All right, so it's tomorrow night. That's Thursday, July 21st at the beautiful Antonella's Restaurante, right, South Coast Plaza. Whole thing starts with a reception about 5:30. There's dinner that follows, and it's a fascinating evening to spend with somebody who's very well-educated, somebody we wouldn't normally interact with because you're just dealing with students and people within the foreign affairs community here. It's a rare opportunity. Do you get asked very often to go out and talk in the public? Probably not very often.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was at Arizona State for 25 years, and the president that came in, he said, you know, our main goal is get out of the freaking ivory tower, get out and engage the community,
please,
and get out and do your job and take in all the information you've gathered over all these years. And I truly believe he had a strong statement on that mission, and I know Dr. Strupa believes the same here at Chapman.
Well,
so we're out there. We're trying to do our best to disseminate as much information, not only to our students, but to the community. And I'm very proud of participating in that process.
Well, that's our mission, too, as a community radio station. And 3 million-plus people in Orange County, there's really hardly any voices left anymore. We don't have traditional radio stations, TV stations, barely a newspaper anymore, unfortunately. And so we've tried to fill that gap and be a voice. And through the one medium everybody carries, their smartphone, the internet these days here. So that's what we do. We stream these programs live and turn them into podcasts, and we'll do the same with this tonight. I encourage everybody listening today live to this program or later through the podcast as we post it on social media, go check it out and go to the site worldaffairscouncil.org and learn more about not just the event tomorrow, but the events that they put on pretty much every month throughout the year on some topic, something to do with foreign affairs. Because as the world goes, so goes California here. I think that's a That's a true statement. Thank you so much for taking the time to come out of the ivory tower, to come down from the ivory tower and talk to the rest of us and try and make sense of what the heck's going on out there.
All right. Well, I appreciate it, and I appreciate the opportunity. I hope we'll be able to talk again soon.
We'll see you tomorrow night at the World Affairs Council talk on the brink, the current state of Latin American politics with Dr. Kyle Longley, right here, the director of the War Diplomacy and Society Program and professor of history right here in our backyard, Chapman University. Thanks so much. See you tomorrow.
All right. Take care.
Well, there you have it. If that isn't something interesting, that's something you don't hear every day. That's the kind of stuff we bring each and every time here on OC Spotlight. People doing the most amazing things. We're giving the most incredible talks right here in our own backyard. Right here in Orange County's only community radio station, OC Talk Radio.net.